Welcome to Vox Vomitus, also known as Word Vomit.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of Vox Vomitus, otherwise known as Word Vomit. I am your host, Jennifer Ann Gordon, the award-winning novelist of Beautiful, Frightening, and Silent, Pretty Ugly, as well as the Hotel series. With me today, as always, is my Vox Vomitus vixen, Allison Martin, author of the award-winning novel Dibs, and Since September and Move On Melinda, otherwise known as the Bourbon Books. With us today is Adele Myers, debut author of The Tobacco Wives. Woo! Welcome, Adele. And happy early book birthday, because your book is still on pre-release, pre-order. It comes out officially March 1st.
Right. Yeah. Next week.
So we're having a premature party for you.
Not premature, just early.
Well, early, but I was thinking, like, this is like, there are incubators in your book. So I was going with a really dark, terrible joke.
There are some incubators. So, yeah.
So on that note, welcome, Adele. Tell our viewers a little bit about yourself and then a little bit about your debut novel, Tobacco Wives.
Sure. So I live in Brooklyn, New York, although I grew up in North Carolina. I spent most of my childhood in Asheville. And my grandparents lived in Winston-Salem, so I spent my summers there with them, and that was a big inspiration for the book. Winston-Salem was like the tobacco capital of the South. But now I'm in Brooklyn, and I work in advertising, and I have a son who's 15 years old. I have a dog who I hope will be quiet during this interview, but I cannot guarantee anything because he likes my undivided attention, so... hopefully he will cooperate.
That is perfectly fine. I have a little dog, and every once in a while he comes up to where I am. I'm on the second floor of my house, and he like comes right underneath, like my camera's here, and he's like right underneath. So sometimes during shows, you'll see me like looking down and going like, because he's like making a little face like, I'm going to jump up. Yeah.
Like, you know, when they're ready.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm like, don't. And Allison has children. So sometimes we hear yelling.
Murdering.
I was not going to say the sound of them killing each other dead.
No, I am very fortunate. My mother-in-law is with them. So it's not like they're just completely Lord of the Flying it out there. They're just...
like a 40-minute podcast, and you come out and they're cannibals. Mm-hmm. You're like, what? I just left the room for 40 minutes.
Can't do it. Mine are all under 15, though, too. So one
15-year-old. They get quieter, like 13, 14. Then
because they stop talking to you?
Yeah, they don't want to have anything to do with you at that point. They occupy themselves. You have to text them to get them to come to dinner.
Please come out now.
Please come out of your room.
There will be fries. Oh, Jen, where'd you go?
Am I back?
She's back. You were only gone for like half a second. I'm like, you just time traveled into.
I know. Everybody went away. And I was just like, Hello. Oh no, it's my weather.
It's weird weather here though, too, because I'm in Southern California and we have clouds and we don't know what to do with them. It's a little weird.
Not sunny.
No, I have like artificial light, which is why you can sometimes see it like in my glasses reflecting. But I'm fine. I'm good.
So Adele, The Tobacco Wives, obviously this is historical fiction, but it's sort of based on your life, a little bit inspired by your life. Mm-hmm. Right. And you are not old enough to be writing historical fiction that's based on your life.
Well, thank you. Very kind of you. And I will say I was not born in the 1940s.
But you have aged miraculously well. And we would have to change.
Yeah, the podcast would all of a sudden become Let's Talk About Adele's Skincare Regime.
Yes. No, it was inspired by my grandmother's story, actually. My grandmother was a hairdresser for the wives of R.J. Reynolds tobacco executives in the 1940s. Wow. And I was always fascinated with just the idea of that, you know, of her being working so closely with these women and doing their hair. And there's, you know, there's something really intimate about that relationship between a hairdresser, but also a dressmaker, which is where I ended up going with my main character. because I wanted her, I wanted to find a way for the character to be inside the home frequently. And so, and actually my other grandmother was a seamstress in Winston-Salem. And so as a young girl, I would help her. Yeah, it was kind of a melding of
put them together.
Relationships and experiences and history, you know, on my family. So that was kind of the spark of the idea.
Well, I love that. And I'll admit that, like, I'm a sucker for books that have, like, a lot of historical fashion involved. So I loved hearing about just the outfits and just, like, the romanticism of women who go to these big, beautiful parties all the time. It's a world we don't live in now.
Nope. Right. Right. It's true. And I had a lot of fun with that. I actually have a couple of pictures that I can show you.
And tell. Show and tell.
So they're both black and white. This is my grandmother who was the hairdresser, and she's actually holding a cigarette. Whoops. She's actually holding a cigarette in the shot, and she's standing next to this car. And it's really funny. In the 40s, a lot of people took pictures next to cars, and I don't even think that the cars were there sometimes, but it was just such a point of pride to be like,
look at this, like, car.
Look at me next to this car, you know? and then this is my other grandmother who was a seamstress.
Did they ever meet by any chance?
My grandmothers?
Yeah. Were they, would they would have met at like the weddings and so forth?
They knew each other. They knew each other very well. You know, both sets of my grandparents were from Winston-Salem. And so I would visit in the summers, and I would actually assist my grandmother who was the seamstress, although not nearly to the extent that Maddie assists her aunt and then takes over for her aunt in the book. She let me cut out some patterns, but that was pretty much it. So I had to do quite a bit of research into sewing because I do not sew. So.
Well, and I crack up because, so my eldest daughter, I have two daughters and a son, and my eldest daughter got her sewing badge for her scout troop, but not because I helped her, because my mother-in-law helped her, because I can't sew either. So if I were to be writing about something like this, I would likewise have to be, I'd be bothering her going, can you please make this make sense? But right. Is this anything logical? Am I making this up? Can you make a hat? How do you make a hat? I loved the part where she was like, oh, I need a hat. Oh, not a turban. Oh, but I need feathers, but not this kind of feather. I love that this character is like, I really am into feathers, but I'm specific about the fowl it came from. That was just...
Absolutely. Yes.
I feel like that scene taught us so much about Cornelia. Actually, just Cornelia walking in wearing mauve and talking about how everybody in Paris is wearing mauve, and now everybody here will wear mauve because I am. I was like, good for you. Well,
and the whole mauve thing came from research that I did, and that was true. That was a very coveted color at that time in history. So I found that was like the spark of it, and I thought, okay, this is a cool way to show who Cornelia is and to also give her this very memorable presence. You know, so you always think of her in her mauve, not purple, mauve.
Well, and it's so funny because I think people do have like signature colors. I mean, just last week we had Eliza Jane Brazier, and one of her characters is like, oh, her signature color is this, and her signature color is that. People still have that, but we don't think about back then you had to actually get the dye and no one else could have that color if the color wasn't around. And I know there was another character where it's like, oh, I want green, but no, not that green, not that green. Hold on, I'm going to have to dye it to make the right color green because, oh, this is important.
Right. Yeah, there were, you know, shortages. And of course, the wealthy people had more access to things than others. But one of the other interesting things that I found that ended up in the book is I ordered old patterns, like vintage dress patterns, just to get a feel for what those are like and to look at them. And I remember seeing many in my grandmother's studio at her home. But there was one that I got that was a dress made out of a feed bag.
Yes.
Which ended up in the book. And I thought, oh, that's such a wonderful, just, you know, timely little detail, which I love
to throw into.
Yeah.
Well, and people may have seen the thing that's been circulating where I think it was Marilyn Monroe posing in a picture of, she's wearing like either a burlap sack, but it's a dress made out of a burlap sack, where it's like, you right. know what? I can pull anything off. And she does.
She yeah. did.
But back then, some of these people, they were wearing things made out of just leftover scraps because they didn't have access to it. And we talk about like right. disposable fashion nowadays. Then it was almost the opposite. You were using the disposed of stuff to right, put in yeah. your clothes, and you may only have a couple dresses. You may not, but then having right. somebody like Maddie, who doesn't come from that world, going, oh no, you can't appear in an event in the same dress. No, no.
Right.
Which of course right. we would never do. This is me scrolling through my Instagram going, when did I last wear the dress that I was going to wear today? Have I worn that on the show recently? Oh, I can't do See, that.
This is why my signature color is black and all of no my clothes knows. Look the same.
Like, they wrong.
Be the same black. Thing.
It's all good.
It's all good. Yeah, I wore a dress that was made out of like feed bags and potato sacks in a play.
How much did that itch? Really?
It was terrible. But I was in To Kill a Mockingbird and I was playing Mayella Yule and she wore like a dress made out of like potato sacky type of thing. And it was so itchy. And I was just like, I would have like a rash all over my whole body. But like it really made me feel like the character.
It made you feel like a sack of potato.
Made me feel like a sack of potatoes. So Adele, have you always been interested in fashion? Is that something that kind of like just happened because of your grandmother and then it went dormant for a while? Or
I think it happened initially because of my grandmother. And then, it's interesting that I ended up writing about it because I'm not necessarily, you know, totally into fashion. I mean, I have an appreciation for it, but it became more of a vehicle to tell the story, I think, and a way to show the difference between the classes of people. And I also just felt like it was fun. You know, it the topic of the book is pretty serious, the dangers of, you know, smoking and big tobacco. And so I wanted there to also be a fun element to the story.
Yeah, so it didn't read super heavy, like, oh, this is going to be us yeah. lecturing about the dangers of tobacco, which fortunately by now in 2022, we know. So right. we were like, right. okay, we're good. But back then, people didn't. And the idea, I mean, you've got scenes in there that you read and you just go, really? Where the doctor's like, here, I'm prescribing you some of these special cigarettes.
And the kid my gosh, the special is cigarettes like, oh, were
for my lungs.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was actually happening back then. Yeah.
Well, that's the moments.
Yeah, yeah, that's what's frightening. I did make up moments, but the whole idea of menthol cigarettes and creating uh-huh. mint flavors, those were designed to appeal to women. And I have
for our fragile nerves.
For our fragile nerves, exactly. I have a couple of examples of ads that I printed out that I could show you. So they used what's called an advertising credentialing, which basically is that they used doctors in order to recommend cigarettes. And a lot of it was about getting out ahead of the negative news about mm-hmm. the dangers of smoking. Like they knew that was coming. And so, and here's another one. It says, not one single case of throat irritation due to Camels.
Oh, not one single case.
You know, and back then doctors were like gods. I mean, they were the ones that were the keeper of all the information. There was no Google. There was no looking up symptoms. You believed what the doctor told you. And so it's pretty frightening what they did and the way that they shaped, you know, the perceptions of the public.
And I'll say that it even went on so much later than we like to think about it going on, because I was born in the 70s. And when my mother was pregnant, she smoked.
Mine too.
And her doctor, I remember my mother telling me this, that her doctor said, as long as you're only smoking 10 cigarettes or less a day, it'll be fine. Because if you try to quit, you'll be too stressed out. And that's worse for the baby than the cigarettes. I exactly. now have terrible yeah. asthma. Do those things go together? I don't know.
Well, it is funny because my father is 6 foot. My mother, before she passed away, was 5'6", and I'm only 5'2", maybe 5'3" on a good day. My sister's a little taller than me. And we're like, how come we didn't get any taller? And my sister's husband's like, it's because your mom smoked while you were pregnant. And my mom's like, no, which probably not. I mean, I doubt that's where it worked, but they're like, oh, you don't want those giant babies. Get those good low birth rates going. Maybe that's not what we want for the babies in the premature set. Like, no, this is not helpful at all.
It's crazy because it wasn't that long ago that, you know, people had these, that it was very different. And I also grew up, my mother smoked, my father smoked. I mean, I feel like my first probably 10 years of life, I rode in the car with
closed smoke windows
and smoking myself.
I think we all have those memories of like being a kid in the back seat being like, can you open the windows? And I remember my dad being like, it's freezing outside. No.
Deal with it, Jennifer. Well, and I know for me, my parents, they didn't smoke in the house. It was only outside. We always grew up and growing up in Southern California, we moved from Pennsylvania when I was 3. So we always grew up in a place where they could go out to a patio and it wouldn't be snowing or anything like that. And they didn't really smoke in the car or the car window would be open. But then I'd visit my grandparents and then I would be in a house where everything, and then I couldn't breathe. And they'd be like, Allison, you're being melodramatic. And I'm like, I'm dying. They're like, you're being melodramatic, but I'm still dying. Okay. Thanks. But I think if anything, it meant that I had no desire to smoke when I got older. And like, there's something to be said about, hey, you want to be cool? Don't be like your parents.
See, you were smart. I still went the smoking cigarettes route in high school.
You went into theater.
I know we had to do something.
I know.
We had to do something every time they said, like, take 5. Like, what do you do? Just stand outside for 5 minutes? No.
Well, and I cultural things do vary though, because I did date a guy at one point where he smoked. And the reason he smoked is he was in the Air Force. And he said, if you smoked, you got more breaks. So a lot of them started smoking because they got smoke breaks, where if you didn't smoke, he didn't get the break. So, you know, it's like the trade-off. And you think maybe everybody should just get the breaks.
That's why you need fake cigarettes that are gum or sugar.
Candy cigarettes, which I have.
Yeah. Then you can be like, I just got to go take a smoke break. And really, you're just having some pure sugar.
Yep.
Speaking of pure sugar, it was really funny because you mentioned a lot of food and drinks in this book, which I love. And some of the scenes, I was like, you mentioned a mint julep, and I have a love-hate relationship with mint julep, which is mostly love. But my problem is, growing up near Disneyland, for me, a mint julep is their version of mint julep, which has no alcohol and is mostly just diabetes in a cup, because it's just like glucose, 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 and a cherry. And it's green and it's beautiful. But then as an adult, I tried a real mint julep and I'm like, what the hell is in this thing? Now I probably would like it. I'd probably be better off with it. I'm still not sure about the flavor combinations, but I read that and I instantly was like, I need a mint julep. And then, you know, I can't get into Disneyland today. It didn't happen. But I did.
I feel like they. Oh, see, you have lemon cookies. I have a hat with feathers. Oh,
I'm not eating the fascinator. I'm eating my cookies.
Oh, I love it. I have a charm bracelet. This is another little item that I was going to show you, because my parents met actually at R.J. Reynolds High School. So this is their 1963 junior senior prom charm.
Tell me that's not a pack of cigarettes.
Is it a pack of cigarettes?
It's just square. It's like a rectangle, like a pack of cigarettes. I'm like, tell me that's not what it's supposed to be.
And I, you know, it was interesting because I went back and kind of looked at a lot of these things. And the more I looked and the more I talked to my family members, the more I realized just how deep the connections were and, you know, to tobacco, like everything in the city. I also have an old yearbook. I'll just hold this up. This was my dad's yearbook. And I realized that if you can see the mascot,
the devil.
Is the devil.
Well, why not?
I never realized that, but okay.
And I guess it's interesting because there are places like North Carolina where the industry completely shapes the culture around there. But then what happens when the industry changes or leaves, or we find out that the industry isn't good for us? How does the community adapt? And I mean, that's really at the heart of your book, of finding out, our way of life, well, it's damaging. So now what do we do? And the choices people have to make, because you can't just be like, all right, well, yeah, people might die. Meh.
But then
have a nice gala.
But also people are dying, but without the industry, then there's no work.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly.
And they're just coming out of World War II, and it's been this terrible time of rations, and the men weren't around, and now that they can come back to this like time of glory. So it's understandable at times why the characters make some of the choices they make.
Right, right. I'm glad you said that and that you felt that way, because I wanted to paint a different portrait and give people a different point of view on, you know, the fall of Big Tobacco. I think it's a story that's well known, but to tell it from a female perspective and also with a love and appreciation for the people of the state and what they built, you know, I felt that, and I hope that came through in the book.
No, it definitely did. And especially, you know, when you think about where there's money, especially big money, there's usually also charity and amazing things that can come out of dirty money. And I think, you know, we know this about the tobacco industry, the alcohol industry, in lesser extent, just like the coal industry. Like, there's so many things that it's like, it's damaging. It's bad for people to work there. But then you look at what happens to a town when the economy dies.
Yeah, and that's tragic. I mean,
it's tragic, and it's not less deadly in many cases.
Right. True. Yeah. I mean, that was one of the things when I talked to my father, because he, you know, he spent some of his summers as a teenager working in the cigarette factories, and so he kind of was able to talk to me about that. Also, what I wanted to know is, it seems almost impossible in this day and age that they didn't know that it was dangerous. But he's like, we really didn't know. Like, up until a certain point, we did not know it was dangerous. And we were so proud of everything that we had built. People had good jobs. They were able to buy homes for themselves. They, you know, every school, library, you know, bank, everything was funded by cigarette taxes. And it really is, you know, that's one of the things I spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, from these characters' point of view. What is it like to suddenly realize that your pride and joy is dangerous? And what do you do with that information? Yeah. So.
Well, and you wove in other issues in there just beautifully, with these other issues of having the different working conditions based on which factory you're in, or whether you're a man or a woman, and just the fact that it's like, okay, well, these women did have to come in from the homestead mostly, but then, okay, well, are we trying to discourage them from staying on as their husbands come back? And that whole dynamic and the idea of like, okay, well, what if the husband died? What if they don't have any other options? And just the idea, and it wasn't just in that, but over and over, is what are the other options and what options do people have? And so often it's like the options are bad option or no option.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. I thought that time in history was a really interesting time because of that dynamic that you just talked about, that women had taken over jobs while the men were at war. And so for most of them, that was the first opportunity they had to make their own money and to get that sense of self-worth and confidence and independence from knowing that you can take care of yourself. And so, you know, clearly, many of them did not want to give that up. And what I thought was interesting also is to juxtapose their experience, as difficult as it was, with the wealthy tobacco wives who didn't have the opportunity to work and who, while they were privileged and wealthy, had very little real power and were basically reliant on their husbands.
Yeah, in many ways, very gilded cages. And I think the variety of women you showed and how each of them kind of handled their place in society differently. One of the characters I thought was very interesting, I'm hoping I don't mess her name up, I think is Rose, who had kind of come from a lower status and married into this, but then had almost a prickliness that she didn't show initially, but about that whole, okay, this, my status is kind of precarious, and the idea of being seen as less than and tossing around epithets like white trash and how that felt, you know, someone like that being in this society where it's like, oh, well, I'm never really at the top of the pecking order. And what does my mother-in-law think of me? And, you know, it wasn't just, okay, well, here's one character. You had a whole whole group of them all dealing with similar situations as far as the larger situation, but their own role in it was so different.
Right.
So Adele, this is obviously your debut novel. Is this the first novel you've ever actually written? Because I know a lot of times our debut novel isn't our first novel that we've
written. It's our 20th.
It's our 20th novel and our debut. So what was your writing experience like before Tobacco Wives, during Tobacco Wives?
Yeah, so for many years, I focused on short stories and essays, and I wrote those. Mainly I took classes at night. I wrote those for my own enjoyment. I, you know, graduated from journalism school and moved to New York shortly thereafter and started working in PR. So I was writing mostly press releases and remarks for media events and things. And my job took up a lot of my creative energy. Although I always knew that I wanted to write a book at some point in my life. And The Tobacco Wives actually started as a short story that I wrote 20 plus years ago in a short story writing class. And at the time, my teacher, you know, gave me some comments and you know, suggestions. And she also made a note. I still have this. I saved it all these years. And she wrote, "I think there's a longer piece here. There may be a novel." And that kind of like planted this little seed with me that has been in the back of my mind all these years. And life was busy. I was building my career. I got married. I had a son. And, at a certain point about 8 years ago, I decided, you know what? I want to do this. I'm going to make a commitment to myself to actually do this. And I didn't work on it, you know, nonstop. Obviously, I worked on it when I could. My life was pretty full at that time, but I set that intention and started slowly working towards that goal. And it technically is my first novel, but I rewrote it probably 5 times and it changed considerably.
We're going to put you in a room with Eliza Jane Brazier and you guys can like fight it out on how many drafts it takes of the same novel.
I kept thinking, "Oh, I'm done. This is awesome. I'm done." And I had no clue. Like, I was pretty naive, I think, coming into this. I thought, you know, I'd finish this manuscript, I'd send it off.
And then fame and fortune happened right away.
Did not happen. I ended up changing the title 3 times.
Ooh, what were the other titles?
So the first title was The Clearing, and that was, I called it that because there was a really pivotal scene in a clearing in this tobacco field. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up cutting that. And so that
cleared
title
that.
Made no sense. Bye-bye. And then the next title was Brightleaf, which is the name of the fictional town. Mm-hmm. Which was fine as a title, I think, but when I was pitching agents, I pitched and tried to find an agent for about a year and a half. And at some point during that process, I decided to take a harder look at my pitch and I decided to change the title of the book. And some of that came from consistent feedback that I was getting from early readers. I've been in a book club forever and my book club actually read the manuscript at one point, and they all gave me feedback, which was terrifying but helpful.
Like, only the good stuff, please.
I know. Like, be honest,
but not too honest. Honest but nice.
Yeah. But in earlier drafts, there was actually a friendship between two girls. One of the tobacco wives, Mitzi, had a daughter, and it was more about the relationship with the Maddie and the daughter. And I kept hearing from multiple people that they weren't that interested in the daughter. They were more interested in the wives and they wanted more of the other wives. And also that was what my grandmother had called them. I just realized it kind of clicked. And I thought that should be the title. And I also spent a lot of time on my pitch letter and really honing that. I found examples of other pitches from authors, like winning pitch letters online. Mm-hmm. And I modeled it after that. And I got a lot more interest. It was pretty amazing. Like,
you're like, just a little tweak and there you go.
Yeah, just a little tweak.
And that really is true for so many people, where it's like, it's not necessarily that the idea doesn't work, but something about it isn't clicking with the people that they need to click with, whether it's agents or editors, whoever. And if you're focusing on that, and if anything else, the title, like Jen and I, for our show here, we read so many books, and The Tobacco Wives feels like the kind of title that's coming out now. So it's like, it's one of those things that feels in the zeitgeist, like it's timely. Yeah. Brightleaf, I like the title, but I don't know anything about what that means.
Right. Yeah, Brightleaf could almost be sci-fi or fantasy. Brightleaf could be the name of an elf.
Right. Yeah, it could be anything. It's true. It conjures an image. And so I think that side of things, the marketing piece and how you position, you know, your work, I think is very important and can make a big difference with writers who are trying to get attention, who are trying to break through, because it's tough. I mean, I had so many rejections, you know, a lot of just waiting. There's so much waiting in publishing.
There's so much waiting.
The waiting is just, yeah, you're like,
it's a different time zone.
Yeah, there's a lot of hurry up and wait, because you have everything from, you've got deadlines on one side where you're going, how am I supposed to get a book done this quickly? And then on the other side, it's like, yeah, but you're not going to hear back for a few months, maybe a year.
Right.
Just go about your business in the meantime. And you're going, how?
Don't obsessively check your email every 2 seconds, just waiting to hear something.
How about now? No. And I think now you say your background, you have that in the marketing. So was that something that you thought was helpful for you? Were you able to kind of bring that in to help you figure out how to market this?
I do think it helped me. It's funny though, that it took me a while to apply it to my own work.
That's the hardest thing to be able to get away from it as the creator, to look at it as, okay, but then how would I get this out there in a way that's going to be receptive for agents and editors? And I don't know how your agent pitched this, or what the draw was, or if you got any say in the cover, because your cover is gorgeous. I don't know if you have
the cover is astounding.
Yeah. I love the cover. And one of my friends described it as a Lily Pulitzer dress with a hand grenade in the pocket. And I love that.
That is a great description.
Isn't that great? Yeah, I think they did such a beautiful job, you know, my editor and the team. And I wanted something that felt kind of provocative, mm-hmm. and that was beautiful, but also hinted at the danger. And I think that they did a beautiful job with it. So I love it. I actually got a manicure. I don't have one now, but I got a manicure where they like replicated the little...
The leaves. Okay, I need to see a picture of that when you have it. So
it's on my Instagram, and it was right after I saw the cover. I'm like, I'm not obsessed. No, not at all.
You're like, my book cover is gorgeous. I also don't have a manicure, so ignore my hands. People who are watching the video, they're like, why are these three women with not done fingernails keep gesturing in front of their faces with them?
Well, and in fairness, I usually have matched my manis when I get a new book out. So I have done that. And one of my favorites, I'm holding my most recent, and there's a good blue in it, and my nails are blue, and I'm holding it in front of this green leaf, and it pops. I'm going, that's it. That's the picture right there. Sometimes it just works. But they work. And the cover for it works so well. And it has this just very elegant literary feel to it that just really sells the book in a way that you go, ooh, what are these Tobacco Wives? The combo there. And mm-hmm. and not that the earlier titles, like The Clearing, could be horror. Brightleaf, probably sci-fi. But Tobacco Wives, there I know what we're getting.
Yeah. You know, I book this show sometimes very many months in advance. And sometimes I just read the title and go, yes, whatever it is, I want it. And I think I saw your book cover, heard the words Tobacco Wives, and I was like, I don't know what that is, but yes, we're going to book her. Sounds great. And I think Allison last week was like, what are we, you know, what's the book for next week? I'm like, it's called The Tobacco Wives. I don't know if it's a thriller. I couldn't remember because I booked it so long ago.
Yeah.
I was like, it might be like rich women killing other people. I'm not sure.
We have already read that one.
But we read something like that recently, so that's why I was like,
I don't think so. It is not. No, it is funny though, because we've read several books where it was set in Low Country area in South Carolina. So it's fair that we finally have a North Carolina representing. Now we have all the Carolinas covered. Next up, we need to find somebody from Virginia or something. We haven't done Virginia, have we?
Sean Cosby, Diane Zinna.
They're both Virginia too? Yeah. Diane's book isn't set in Virginia, is it?
Yes, it is.
It was?
See, or Maryland, I think, actually.
Maryland, all right. Well, we'll work our way down south.
Yeah.
Keep moving on down. It's good.
And I love that you're from Asheville. I love Asheville. When I was...
Oh, yeah.
Allison and I were just talking about North Carolina, and I'm just like, oh, some of it's so like cool and artsy. And I was thinking about Asheville, and I'm like, and the mountains are gorgeous.
And then it is. You know, it's undergone a renaissance, that the whole area. You know, when I grew up there, we did not have, you know, the restaurants, and it's always been beautiful, but it really has become, like, some people call it the Brooklyn of the South. Like, it's become a destination for, you know, travel, great restaurants, art scene, writers. I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful place.
So what are you working on now? Are you allowed to talk about it?
I can talk a little bit. I mean, I'm in the very early stages, and I've started to do some research and work on a concept for a second book that will also be set in the South, and that will also involve a dangerous cover-up situation. So that's as much as I can talk
about. I want to start doing wild speculation that will just be completely off, like smuggling sea turtles or something. Key West, and then it's Ernest Hemingway's cats are involved in it. This is why I don't write thrillers involving cover-ups, because mine are implausible even in the pitch.
But I feel like that pitch you just did, I was like, people would read that.
Probably. Yeah. See, the thing is, my idea, all that stuff kind of is Carl Hyacinth stuff, and his stuff is so over the top, which is what I love. But then the plausibility is like, did this happen? Don't really care. Was it fun to read? Yes.
Yeah. I like the hidden history aspect of that. And what I'm looking at doing next is not as well known as, I mean, obviously everyone knows about Big Tobacco, but this is more of a little known cover-up situation that I think will be interesting in a different way for readers.
Well, sometimes that's even more fun, just because as a reader going in, going, you know what? I know cigarettes are bad. So when you're reading it going, this kid is asthmatic, it is smoking. You're sitting there cringing going, Wyatt, oh, David, don't. Okay. And at some point, you're glad that he finds out that maybe he shouldn't keep doing that. But if you're talking about something that maybe even the reader doesn't know, that brings a whole new level to it, because then they're uncovering with you. Whereas for the tobacco one, that wasn't really a spoiler alert. Cigarettes are bad.
Cigarettes are bad. When you're having an asthma attack, please do not light a cigarette.
Right. I mean, the show. Like, this is a non-smoking show.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a challenging part of writing the book, because everyone knows the story. You know? It's like the Titanic. You know that the Titanic sunk, but
some people hadn't heard.
Titanic was still one of the biggest movies that's ever been. So there you go.
All M. Night Shyamalan needing to have a giant twist. It's okay. Sometimes we know the boat sinks and that cigarettes are bad for you.
Yeah.
Right.
And you told the story of Maddie and her experience and your tobacco wise experience, and not necessarily just like the blanket big tobacco's bad.
Yes.
Damn the man. Let's
Down with Joe Camel. No.
Down with Joe Camel.
Well, I saw it earlier. You had one of the pictures of had Joe Camel. And I just remember, I want to say it was either late 80s or early 90s when they really had Joe Camel as like this marketing thing that was really pushed to kids. And then they were outlawing all that. Cause I remember my dad getting like Camel Cash and all these items that were merch that had Joe Camel, very cartoon like, and going, oh, but we're not marketing this to children. And I'm thinking, I don't like Joe Camel. He's dumb, but still.
But there were like stuffed animals. And he wore like a leather jacket. He was cool.
He was so cool.
Yeah. It was clearly targeting teens. And eventually the FTC cracked down on them and cracked down on cigarette advertising, but they still got creative and found other ways. Like, advertising on radio and television was outlawed, but then they just started putting more money into print and
magazines
and sponsorships and found ways around it. So, yeah.
Well, that's what happens when people are ridiculously rich.
They wear really pretty dresses.
They wear really pretty dresses and they find ways to continue being very rich because.
Right, right. Giving that up is hard to do.
Yep. Probably just as addictive as the cigarettes.
And these cookies.
And the cookies. And fashion. Adele, you have been hilarious, amazing to talk to. Thank you for being one of our few guests that bring us show and tell items. I love that.
Sure, no problem.
Eventually, no problem. I'm going to send you some
of these candy cigarettes. I will send you some of these. I can't promise that they're fresh. It's vintage candy, but they are
fresh vintage candy.
Fresh vintage candy. I'm just now excited for the whatever book we have next that has like smoking main characters in it, because then I can name drop you in your book during the show while I fake smoke a candy cigarette.
Now so, you're going to go out of your way to try to book somebody who has like a cigarette protagonist. I can't think of one on the top of my head, but it'll happen.
It'll happen. It'll happen. So thank you, Adele, for being here. Thank you. Allison, of course, for being amazing. Thank you to Roman, our producer. This has been Vox Vomitus. If you are watching this on the replay on YouTube, please hit like and subscribe. Vox Vomitus on YouTube. It's also your home for Let's Scare Jennifer to Death and To the Moon, Allison. So you'll get three shows on the Vox Vomitus YouTube channel. So even if you're not watching this on YouTube, go to YouTube, look it up, hit like and subscribe. And if you happen to be listening to this on iTunes or anywhere, just a quick little review would be amazing. And we will see you all next week. Bye!